Hello and welcome back to the NovPod, a beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. Welcome to episode 3. Today we are discussing anaesthesia on labour ward. I'm one of your co-hosts, Owen, an anaesthetic registrar. We're very proud to be launched in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Obstetric Anaesthetic Association. The views, thoughts and opinions of myself, Rosie and Serena on this podcast are that of our own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the RCOA or OAA. As mentioned today, we are going through a run-through of the interventions and procedures we do as anaesthetists on labour ward. My partner in crime, Rosie Grimes, is joining me, along with an anaesthetic novice, Serena Sidhu, who has an interest in medical education and will be asking Rosie and I questions from how to do epidurals. And I apologise, I describe how to do an epidural on the podcast. We also get on to anaesthesia for caesarean sections and general anaesthetic on labour ward. As ever, if you like the episode, please do share it with your colleagues and friends. And we have some links in the bio to have a look at. Without further ado, on to the episode. Hello, and welcome back to the NovPod. This is episode 3, Anaesthetic Techniques on Labour Wards.
Woo!
Woo-woo! As you can guess by the woos, I'm joined by my co-host, Rosie Grimes.
Hi there.
Okay, thank you for the introduction. Rosie is an anaesthetic registrar who has a special interest in obstetric anaesthetics working in London. My name's Owen Dorr. I'm an anaesthetic registrar working in Thames Valley. And today we are joined by Serena Sidhu, who is an anaesthetic novice. Hello, Serena.
Hi, Owen.
Hi. And?
And Rosie.
Yeah, good. We can't forget Rosie here, can we? Serena is a fantastic novice who has an interest in education. She did a PG Cert and has been running a lot of the empowering management and leadership and anaesthesia in Thames Valley at Reading with myself. And you had some questions about labour ward, didn't you, Serena?
Oh, yeah, I've got many questions.
You've got many questions. And what's good is you've written them down, so you're more prepared than me and Rosie today, which is lovely. You're about to start on labour ward very shortly. How are you feeling about it?
Mixed emotions, I think. It's always described as Marmite, right? And I guess the majority of trainees I've come across so far don't seem to be the biggest fan of OBS.
Okay.
So I'm quite apprehensive, hence the questions.
Yeah, I think that's a normal way to feel. Obviously, we have a bit of an interest in OBS, so we're probably a bit biased towards it. We like it. And hopefully through the course of this series, it will become apparent why. But I think what would be really helpful is if you just used us as a sounding board today, get all your questions out, and hopefully we will try and provide some clarity, maybe, to what can be a bit of a muddy voodoo area. Serena, you have done a couple of sessions on labour ward already, is that right?
Yeah, so there's one dedicated C-section list, but most of it has just kind of been moral support for the SHO on nights if I'm free and there happens to be nothing else. So I'll go keep them company and observe in a corner.
That's nice. It can be a little bit lonely sometimes. So what have your observations been so far, or were there any burning things that came up?
So I guess my observations so far have been that it seems to be quite a stressful area in anaesthetics, and a lot more of your patients are awake.
Hopefully.
Yeah, and you go in with one patient and you come out with two, and there's lots of different procedures and drugs used compared to in general theatres. So very different is what I've drawn from my experiences there so far.
So that's actually in reverse to the 97 paper by the Spice Girls et al, when two become one. This is when one become two, isn't it? So, because I would counteract that when people say it's a place that they don't enjoy being. That actually is probably, if you were to ask me for my top five medical experiences, a few of them, two or three, will probably be in obstetrics, because being part of that journey of someone and witnessing a child being born is a fantastic service to be provided of. And being able to do it safely, firstly, and then do it so that you can give someone a good experience is probably one of the most rewarding things you can do. And that whilst it may seem chaotic, that's because there's a lot of moving parts. But if you learn about them and how you can, in some cases, influence or predict what is coming up, it can make your experience and the women you're looking after's experience
way better. And I know that you'll do that particularly. I've got a feeling you're going to be a great obs in this arena.
We'll listen to this back when you're like the head of obs in however many years' time. Oh, and God. You'll be like, remember when that time when I went on a podcast?
An epidural is a plastic tube that is inserted into the epidural space that gives low dose, local anaesthetic, usually levobupivacaine or bupivacaine, mixed with an opioid such as fentanyl, that is designed to help reduce or get rid of the pain of labour. There are some reasons that you wouldn't put one in. Can you think of a reason that you wouldn't want to put one in? Well, it's probably going to be due to coagulation, a bit like what we would normally do. So people have got poor coagulation, bleeding disorders, or if they've recently had therapeutic lamellar weight heparin, the same things that you wouldn't do a spinal. But also other reasons, patients may not want to do them. That's what's very important when you start out, to say this is for your pain. But if you find it too difficult putting it in, we can stop. There are special circumstances. If you've got local sepsis and cellulitis or an abscess, or you've got back surgery, these are also contraindications as well, along with an allergy to amide local anesthetics. So those are reasons that you wouldn't do one, right? But reasons that you would do them is that you say it is associated with better pain control throughout labour. It is our gold standard. They may not just be for people who have requested them. You can be offered them if, for example, someone has twins, or a bit more of a sensitive subject, but intrauterine death. Those are other times that you may offer them.
And can they have one at any point in labour? Or does there come a point where it's too late and they're progressing too quickly?
This can be a bit dependent on the operator, right? So if I've got a woman who is fully dilated, then I will say, guys, we need to reassess here, because the epidural takes about 45 minutes to work. It's not a bang instant like a spinal. Yeah. It takes a while for those drugs to infiltrate and work properly. And so if someone's about to deliver, you're putting them at all the risks of an epidural without any of the benefit. Mm-hmm. And so I would advocate for not doing one in those settings, but these are case by case basis.
Okay. I think as well, in that situation, there are other options. And I don't think we would ever say to a woman, you can't have an epidural because you're fully dilated, but you might have a nice conversation, or as nice as you can get when someone's in a lot of pain, where you say, look, I'm a bit worried that we might put this epidural in for you and you won't get any of the benefit from it, but you'll get the risks. So yeah. There are some other things that you can do in that scenario. And some of the things that can be quite helpful are things like a single shot spinal using the low dose epidural mix, which can sometimes last just for that end bit of labour and take the edge off. But we do need to be mindful that if this is your first labour, even if you're fully dilated, you might still have an hour for descent and then an hour of pushing. So potentially still got a bit of that labour left. And so to be told you can't have anything is not going to be ideal. But to have a conversation where you come to a decision together, and maybe a compromise such as a low dose single shot spinal, which is usually quite nice and reliable and just takes the edge off a little bit.
And that acts quicker.
The onset of that will be quicker, yeah. Mm. They're also sometimes used to help provide some immediate pain relief if you've got somebody who's in a lot of pain and you want to put an epidural in, but because of how much discomfort they're in, they're having trouble sitting in that epidural position. So they can be quite helpful for that as well.
Quite nice, yeah.
Other things that you might be careful when you put them in is if someone has got an infection. So you need to be wary of, with sepsis, whether or not A, it increases the risk of them getting an epidural abscess, B, whether or not they've got such bad infection it's affecting their clotting. There's also other conditions that we'll go on to in our pathophysiology episodes called preeclampsia, which is, well, it's a disorder of the fetal blood circulation and adherence, and means that lots and lots of vasoactive media get released into the mother, which can cause a real spike in blood pressure, but it can also cause disorders of coagulation. So it can cause DIC. So it's very important in those women that they have 6-hourly blood checks to make sure their platelets are all right or more.
So how do you put an epidural in?
So you're going to need a cannula in. because as you block off pain, you block off the sympathetic system that causes vasodilation that can dump the blood pressure, okay? So you need a mechanism to make the blood pressure high, because if mum's blood pressure is low, so is baby's, because there's hardly any autoregulation within the uterine arteries. Secondly, they need 15 to 20 minutes of CTG monitoring for exactly the same reason. This is an act that can disturb the baby's happiness. So you need to know whether or not the baby medically and physiologically is going to go low heart rate afterwards. That could be a signal of hypoxia, low blood pressure, because they need to continuously monitor it, and they should do this throughout the epidural as well to know whether or not that baby needs to come out right now, okay? Also is the element of looking at the blood tests, make sure you know their past medical history, making sure you know their obstetric history, paying attention to high blood pressure, drug allergies, and then consent. So my standard patter would be, we put this in for your pain relief, and it is for you. So if you find it too difficult putting in, we'll just stop, okay? And we'll chat about it, and then we can go about and do different things. I'll explain everything that I'm doing to you, but usually I inject some local anesthetic around your back when you're in the position where you're sat up holding a pillow, as if you are holding two heavy shopping bags, to push your back out. Because position is key here. A bad position can really affect your epidural. The other thing is that I won't do anything during your contractions unless I've gone too far. At some point, you will get electric shock sensation as I'm passing the epidural catheter. If it doesn't go, we will take it out, okay? But let me know if you're feeling any sensations. This is a technique that has got some complications associated with it. So common is that it will lower your blood pressure, and that's due to the sympathetic system getting blocked, which causes vasodilation. This can leave you feeling sick, dizzy, and even make you vomit, but that is a sign of you having low blood pressure. So if you feel those symptoms, you let your midwife know straight away so they can check your blood pressure, because if your blood pressure is low, so is baby's. Other things that can happen is feeling itchy, a little bit uncomfortable due to some of the things that are in the epidural mix, including the fentanyl. 1 in 10 of the epidurals may need adjustments and stronger medications given through them, or they may need to be resited, so success isn't guaranteed in this setting. You may need a catheter because you won't be able to do star jumps afterwards. With the pain block, there is a degree of motor block. There's also an association of increased forceps deliveries. We also have the slight risk that as you are passing a needle near to where your shock absorber for your brain is lying, that we can puncture that, and that's called a posterior puncture headache, and that leaves you with a really bad headache. That's normally about 1 in 100, so 1 per small village. We then also have the risks of some rarer things occurring. You can have nerve damage, and that's patchy sensation loss or motor loss that can occur in 1 in every 13,000. That's 1 every small town. And then there is a risk of 1 in 250,000, which is 1 every small city the size of Exeter, of you being unable to move your legs, and that's known as paralysis. So these are all serious complications to know about. And then, are there any further questions that you have? And I would also advocate that they read the Labour Pains website. It's very good. There's lots of translations. It's developed by the Association of Anaesthetists, the Royal College of Gynaecologists, and by the Midwives Council. It is a very good resource for them being able to go through it at their own pace. I would advocate that you never have a partner translating. It must be via language line or via a staff member, because you don't know what's being said and it may not be informed consent. And then I'll go and get all my stuff ready. So I'll say it's like setting up for a cocktail. It's like I'm making an espresso martini back here, but dependent on the person I'm doing it for. Get everything lined up, feeling for toughness line, which is where you look for the ACEs at the front and you feel round to the back for the corresponding level. And that should be L3, L4, where you're going. Because you don't want to go at L1, where the spinal cord ends in the majority of the patients you're looking. You want to go lower down to where you're getting the quarter equino and you just have the dural sac, because you want to avoid any nerves. Then what we do to site the epidural is we insert the needle through to skin, through to the supraspinous, interspinous, into the ligament of flavium, that then goes into the epidural space. Okay, so you might think of it as a cheese board.
You read my mind, Owen.
I read your mind. It's delicious.
I hate this analogy.
It's
so
a delicious cheese board. So, what do you start off with our cheese board? We normally start off with a goat's cheese or a brie, and that's the skin or subcutaneous tissue. So, the needle's going to go in very easily into that delicious brie. And then we hit supraspinous. And I would consider that to be a harder cheese, like a mature cheddar. And you'll notice when it goes in that the needle now has bite to it, okay? So now from the needle, you'll pull out the inner tube and then you will push the needle with the saline syringe on the end through the interspinous ligament, which could be considered to be a cheese such as Edam cheese, slightly harder cheese. And then it goes, sorry to all the vegans out here, but I'm sure it's vegan equivalents. You'll then go into your ligament flavium, which is a crunchy ligament, which can crunch through a bit like layers of Parmesan. Okay? And then as soon as you go into the epidural space, that saline syringe will start to go forward and you'll notice a loss of resistance, which is known as LOR, and then that signifies how far you went. Okay.
Is that the middle of the burrata?
That is. That would be a burrata, actually. A delicious burrata. So that's the analogy of cheese. So sorry to all you cheese fans that I've put off eating a block of cheese ever again.
Can I ask about the loss of resistance?
Yes. Mm.
Does that rely on you having not moved? Could you still get loss of resistance if you're in the CSF?
Yes.
Yes. Good question.
With that loss of resistance, you could be in the epidural space or you could be in the intrathecal space. Absolutely. If your syringe comes back at you when you take your thumb off, or if when you twist the syringe off, you've got a splurting of fluid back at you, you are in the intrathecal space and you've done a dural puncture.
Which the OAA have just released guidelines on that you can put a catheter in and consider, but that is advanced techniques that will be based on consultants' decisions.
Yeah, and we've got an episode on that later on. Don't panic if that happens to you. It's a 1 in 100 risk. We'll talk about how to manage that later on. But yes, you would get a loss of resistance in both of those spaces. Mm. Hopefully, you get your lovely loss of resistance, and because you've been going very, very slowly and carefully, you don't get the plunger coming back at you. You twist the syringe off, and you haven't got a significant amount of fluid coming back.
But that's why knowing the centimetres on your needle is really important. And then ultrasound is very important, because you would be able to estimate the gap that you should be going to. Because usually the epidural space is anything between 0.3 to 0.5 millimetres away from the intrathecal sac. So we're not dealing with centimetres of room here, right? So you need to know precisely how far your needle is in and be able to do it carefully and controlled forward, going really a millimetre at a time, really, with it in a controlled manner.
And if you think about the cheese board analogy, as much as I detest it,
yum, yum, yum.
Often towards the point where you're nearly there, you've gotten to that bit where you're in the ligamentum flavum, and so your resistance is quite high. So you need to be careful at that point, because you're probably pushing relatively hard. So that's why the guarding of the wings of the needle so that it doesn't go further is really important. And all of this is not well explained in a podcast. You'll pick it up as you do them and you'll kind of get the feel. But if you're getting to the point in the epidural where it's feeling a little bit harder, you're probably just off.
And you can sometimes hit bone, which is a very crunchy sensation. And I would attribute that, if we're using our cheese board analogy, to putting it into brick. Okay.
You've hit the board. Cheese.
You've hit the actual board of the cheese board. Okay. Yeah. So
you got the resistance.
You got the resistance.
Loss
of resistance. A couple of things when you're putting it in. If the woman is saying, "Ow, that's on my right side, I feel it," then you could be near a nerve root. So you need to, depend on the situation, I'd heavily advise removing that needle and reciting and saying, "Was that on the left? Was that on the right?" People normally know when you've got a needle in their back whether or not you're midline, okay? So if you are struggling, do ask the patient how they're feeling, left, right. And if you are struggling, I would advocate, 2-3 goes and then asking for someone senior?
Yeah, and I think as well, if you're struggling, have a strategy for thinking about where you think the tip of your needle is and adjusting your strategy based on that. So for example, say you've gone in flat. Normally you would go in pointing towards the head slightly and you're trying to get between the spinous processes, right, which are pointing downwards slightly. So if you go in and you hit bone and then you just come back slightly and angle up more, If you then make less progress in that direction, then don't keep doing that. You're not progressing.
It's in a vertical.
Yeah. So if that doesn't work, try angling down slightly. So visualize the spine and think about where you think your needle tip will be. And if you're moving in a positive direction, i.e. you are getting more of your needle in, then carry on. But if you're not and you're not getting it in any direction, then it might be time to think about moving spaces, for example. One of the most common things when you first start is you're so worried about going too high that you actually go too low, and you make things harder for yourself by trying to do an epidural in a smaller gap.
Yeah. And the other very big thing to be aware of is, guess what they're in? Labour. They're going to have contractions, okay? So, yeah, you can inject the local anaesthetic around, but with the epidural needle, you do not want to be sighting an epidural needle into an epidural space when the epidural veins will be engorged. So if they're in labour and they've got high intra-abdominal pressure, hold off. You say, don't worry, it's all gonna, it'll be fine. Let's go breathe through long and strong with your breaths, and we'll carry on when you are not having a contraction. Okay, because otherwise you're going to put that 18 gauge straight into the side of the vein and cause a hematoma.
Mm.
Or you could do in theory.
And I guess they're not exactly staying still at that point either. It makes your life a lot harder.
No one ever benefited from telling someone off for not sitting still during an epidural when they were having a baby. So think about how you can be calm, positive, say they're doing well, express the position you need them to be in. If they are jumping off the bed, which I have had a couple of times, well, I'm trying to sight an epidural, you've got to think about safety, right? You're going near with a needle, near nerves. They're not going to thank you if you give them postural puncture headache because you were unable to get them into the right position. Other things that are quite important is when you are inserting that catheter, you look at the depth to which it's gone. But as you're inserting it, it will brush past some nerves. That's quite discomforting. So you do warn as you do that and say it will go. If it doesn't go and they're still having shooting pain, remove the epidural. The more senior I get, the more pro I am removing epidurals if there's issues like that, okay? Then you would do some testing. So there is something called a menisci drop, where if you hold it high, if it's in a negative space, it should go down. However, this still does happen if you've done an intradural puncture and put a epidural in. In theory, if you lift it high enough, it will still go down. You then have the aspirate, because you do not want to have placed it into a vein. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So those are the main safety checks that you're doing. You then place a filter on. If the patient's had a blood pressure within the last 20 minutes, I will then there's the time to do
a test dose.
And what you're looking for then is how quickly the BROC rises, how quickly the woman's pain goes away, whether or not they're sympathetic and the feet are warm within 5 minutes. These are all bad signs. Or the blood pressure lowers within about 5 minutes. We're talking about going to like 60s. Yeah, because that's a sign that you've placed something
intrathecally,
and you go, what do you do? You call the friends after you've resuscitated the woman and her blood pressure. Yeah, that's a lot about epidurals. Do you have any other questions?
I did have a question about how you troubleshoot them. Say you talked about patchy blocks or one-sided or whatever. Like, what can you do?
Okay, so a woman's come in. They've had an epidural, it's not working on one side.
Okay, so first of all, I would go and see that woman. I would say, I've heard your epidural's not working wonderfully for you, and I would establish what she can feel, what sensations, where. Is it one side or the other? Is it suprapubic pain, for example? That's quite common, especially later on in labour. And then I would perform an assessment of the block. So first of all, I'm going to be looking at, when was it put in? Was it me? Did I think it went normally? Did someone else do it and say it was a bit tricky? Whereabouts did they document the catheter into? So say they left it at 9 centimetres at the skin, and I look at it and it's now at 6, maybe it's come out a bit. And then I would use an objective method of assessment. So I'd ask the woman to raise both legs one at a time, see if there's any objective difference, see if both feet are warm and dry. So warm and dry feet are a sign of a good sympathetic block. Sometimes you'll immediately be able to feel one is colder than the other, and that might be the side that woman is complaining of pain on. Then I would use ethyl chloride spray to assess where the sensory block is up to on both sides. And my aim is to try and get the block up to a good level. So we're aiming for around about T10 on both sides. That's where I'm going. That's what I'm aiming for. So if it was entirely one-sided, I might be thinking that the catheter is just slightly asymmetrical in the epidural space. So in that instance, you can either try topping up the block, or you can withdraw the catheter by 1 centimetre if you think you've got enough space to do that, and then give a top up, turning that woman onto that side, i.e. bad side down, to try and get more of the epidural solution down there. Then I would reassess in 10 to 15 minutes. If you've got a well topped up block on both sides, but you've got, for example, a missed segment, sometimes you can use an extra top up either from the pump or from yourself, or you can use a stronger solution. There are also options such as adding in fentanyl, particularly is quite good for suprapubic pain if they're feeling that bit of pressure. There will be loads of different troubleshooting options depending on where you work. There'll be preferred strategies from the powers that be. The main thing I would say on this is, from your assessment, try and work out what the problem is, i.e. is it a one-sided block? Is it patchy but up to a good level overall? Has it never worked? If it's never worked, just take it out and do a new one. And what I would overall say is, have a very low threshold for offering a resite. So if you have tried one thing and it hasn't worked, at the very, very most, try one more thing. And if that doesn't work, take it out. Do not persist with a poorly working epidural, because you're just going to be on the back foot.
Yeah, and also you are often going to be away in theatre for 2-3 hours at a time. Although you might say, oh, on our third go, we will, maybe I'll resite it. Actually, you can't promise that you're going to be there in 4 hours, and sometimes it's better just to take it and resite it. But that's in consultation with what they would want, how they found putting it in, and if they say, oh, well, see how it goes as well. So that's epidurals, epically. We've epically done epidurals. So
epidurals could be like a whole episode.
Yeah, we could talk about them forever, but it's the main things that we're talking about is why we put them in, consent. And then we talked about some cheeses, and then we've talked about what to do when your cheese ball goes awry.
Attention anaesthetists. Are you looking for a more efficient way to manage your medical rotas and clinical allocations? Are you on a hospital rota and wish it was easier and quicker to manage your own shifts? Introducing Hosportal, the rostering platform designed by anaesthetists for medical professionals like you. With Hosportal, you can track your shifts, manage leave, and make changes. As an administrator, you can significantly reduce the effort to build rosters and keep them up to date, all in real time from any device. It's seamless, reliable, and tailored to the unique demands of medical teams. With 15 years of experience in anaesthesia in Australia and suitable for hospitals all over the world, Hosportal streamlines your work so you can focus on providing exceptional care. Join thousands of healthcare professionals who trust Hosportal to simplify their scheduling. Visit hosportal.com today to learn more and arrange a demonstration. That's hosportal.com. Hosportal, professional scheduling made simple.
So now I know a lot more about epidurals, but you've told me that there's people who can't have them. So what do I do for them?
You can consent and set up people for a room fentanyl. There are some important things to note about this. Firstly, the person will need to be on continuous monitoring, including SATs. Secondly, they need a prescribed midwife for one-to-one. The midwife must always be in the room, so sometimes they can't be done due to midwifery staffing levels. Three is that only the patient can press it, because I've heard anecdotally of partners pressing it. And four is that they need to be almost counselled for it, that this is something that can take almost 20 seconds to come on, but it wears off just as quickly. So otherwise you're going to be incredibly anxious if you're in an incredible amount of pain, that the technique's not working, it's worn off really quickly. No, it's meant to do that. So there's a few things that you need to make them aware of. Okay, other thing is that you can't give it with other opioid drugs. It's a strong drug and it can't be offered on midwifery delivered units. Okay, so what do you want to know about what we do in theatres then?
I guess, how is it different from working in general theatres? I know the procedures will be different, but I guess it's a whole different patient group and different considerations for each of the techniques that you may or may not be familiar with from general.
Yeah, so I guess if you're coming to theatres, it's thinking about what the patient's coming to theatre with or for. And so what state are they in physiologically, and what anaesthesia are you going to give to them, which will differ depending on what it is, right? So if it's a C-section and they don't have an epidural already, then we're thinking, is this a spinal or is this a general anaesthetic? And that will depend on patient factors and the urgency of the cesarean section and what your plan kind of was already. So if you've got time and you're doing a spinal, then the process would be coming into theatres, going through a check-in, WHO checklist type situation, making sure you've got IV access, making sure you've got all your emergency drugs, fluids, monitoring, a phenylephrine infusion drawn up, ready and started. And often people will start that on like point one with a plan to turn it up as soon as you put the spinal in, but all attached, making sure like your three-way taps are pointing in the right directions, cleaning the back and then going through your spinal. So your spinal is essentially very similar to your epidural, except for you're going with a much smaller needle all the way into the intrathecal space, so you can relax about the postural puncture. Relatively similar setup and positioning, cleaning the back, putting some local anaesthetic into the skin where you think you're going to go, introduce a needle in to where you think is appropriate. Note that you don't always have to put that all the way in, especially in smaller women. Just be mindful that you can actually do a spinal tap with the introducer, which you don't want to do. And then putting your spinal needle in until you feel that nice give and seeing the CSF come back and injecting your spinal mixture, which will be a volume of usually 0.5 heavy Marcaine, bupivacaine, with 300 of diamorphine or a mixture of fentanyl and morphine if that's what you use in your institution. The volumes that you give will differ, again, depending on the patient and where you work. I found this really confusing when I started Obs Anaesthetics, but the volumes that people will use will be usually anywhere between 1.8 and 3 mils of local anaesthetic,
okay,
depending on what you're doing and the size of the woman and what that person's normal practice is.
Secondly, is that you need to continuously monitor the CCG. Do not see this as an annoyance, okay? There have been lots, sadly, of baby-related incidences where the baby's not come out very well and the baby was not monitored during the spinal, and that's one of the first things they will look at, rightly so, but the baby needs to be monitored throughout, because if that baby has a significant bradycardia, that would change how quick the baby needs to come out and whether or not you're going to attempt a second spinal versus a GA. So continuous CTG monitoring.
Once that spinal has gone in, very quickly, you need to lay the woman down, do a 15 degree left lateral tilt. Do not, or be very, very, very cautious about putting people in any sort of head down position. In general, we would keep them flattish. Just on the headpiece of the bed, you can just tilt the neck so that they've got some cervical flexion there. That will often sort of reduce the risk of too much spread up towards the brainstem, which is what we'd like to avoid.
The important bits.
Yes. And then turn up your phenylephrine infusion and start a timer.
So in terms of checking, there are guidelines from 2022 about what you do in terms of light touch and straight leg raise. And I suggest you read your local departmental policy.
There are other things that we do spinals for as well. Other procedures that can come to theatre are things like manual removal of placenta. If somebody's delivered vaginally but they have not managed to deliver the placenta, you would do all of the same things that you would do for a cesarean section. You would anticipate bleeding, and your block height that you're going for is T6, because you don't need it to be as high as for the cesarean section, mm-hmm, but you still need good coverage. Other things are perineal tear repairs. They're also quite common. You need a sacral block for that. So again, not as high as you would need for a C-section. And again, mindful of bleeding. But there are probably usually less pressure associated with those because the baby is already out. Other procedures that require a spinal, potentially antenatally, women might come in for cervical cerclage. Some places have policies for those whereby they use short-acting spinals such as prilocaine, or you might just do a normal spinal of a lower volume just to get that cervical coverage. So those are other procedures that we would do in theatre.
It's also forceps deliveries, right? They can do forceps deliveries in room. They do a specialised block for that. But some of these need to occur in theatre. You need to be prepared for some of your forceps delivery to transition into a cat section, which would be a cat one. Okay, so you need to be confident that block isn't just working to where they're going to be pulling out, that this would provide surgical anesthesia if they need to provide a cesarean section, right? Categories. So like cats, you mean different things depending on how many groups there are. Okay, so cat one is a audit standard. So this doesn't mean that you should be delivering by the standard, but Cat 1s are where there is immediate threat to mother or baby's life, and that baby should be delivered within 30 minutes. Cat 2 is where there is an immediate danger to mother or baby's health, and that baby should be delivered within 75 minutes. A Cat 3 is where there is a physiological harm possibly to mother or baby's health, and the baby should be delivered within 24 hours. And then Cat 4 is an elective section where the mother, for various reasons, would need a cesarean section. Now, it's an audit standard, right? So you'll hear the term a quick Cat 2. What that means is that to the obstetricians and the midwives, there is a bad risk of physiological harm to the mother and the child, and they want that baby out soon. And a very quick Cat 1 is where there are differences between potentially life-threatening and actually life-threatening. And so there, you'll learn the nuance of it's sort of a scale of how quick you need to go.
So categories 1 to 4, okay, an audit standard, great. What's probably more useful is a conversation between you and the obs reg or consultant, whoever's on, saying, how long do I have? When do you want this baby out? And sometimes you'll get as quickly as possible, which isn't necessarily the most helpful. Mm-hmm. But if you ask the right questions, you will often get helpful answers. So if you say, she's got an epidural in that's working nicely, but it might take me 20 minutes to get a good block, is that okay? And they say, yes, then great. You can start with an epidural top up, knowing that if you get some severe compromise on the CTG, perhaps you might have to convert to a quicker technique. If they say, no, I need this baby out within the next 10 minutes, you know really that you haven't got time to embark on a long-winded technique. So whatever conversation you have kind of guides you as to how long you've got. There is sometimes a misconception that a general anaesthetic is quicker than a spinal. There is something called a rapid sequence spinal, whereby you go into theatre and you pre-oxygenate the patient. So get your ODP to help you. Start pre-oxygenating the patient, and while you have one attempt at a quick spinal, you can be pre-oxygenating. If you get that spinal in quickly, great, you could potentially have a very, very quick block and you've provided anaesthesia really quickly. If you haven't, you know that you haven't got time to persist. The patient's already pre-oxygenated and you can give a safe GA.
And that brings us on to GAs. So GA in a appendicitis that we have done together for a while. And we've also done GAs on ITU together, haven't we? So
yeah, very different experience.
They're very, very different experiences. Yeah. So general anaesthetics are different to your RSI of your appendix. You're going to have multiple team members in. So you've got the anaesthetics team, you've got the theatre scrub team, you've got the obstetricians, the midwives, you've got the neonatal resuscitation. There's five different major roles, and you've got the patient and her birthing partner potentially. When the spinal hasn't worked or if they need to move to a general anaesthetic, common guidance currently is that the partner is moved out. You need to work out whether or not this person is suitable for a GA quickly. Some people who may not be suitable, people not hemodynamically stable, even if the baby is not well, it's for mother's health to come first. Those are more of the rare occasion, if I'm honest. You've then also got people who may not be suitable for a Cat 1 GA. Those might be people of, let's say, a BMI of 60, for example. But this would have been discussed, and that's why knowing people on the wards and what you would and wouldn't do in counselling them beforehand is a priority, because you may need your consultant in to anaesthetise that person. But let's say it's not that. But everyone else needs to be in theatre when you're doing a general anaesthetic, and it occurs in theatre. You can't put the patient to sleep and then call them in the theatre, because the longer that baby is having anaesthetic drugs transfer over to its system, the worse the APGAR score is. And then go through your RSI checklists, make sure you've got your drugs, your emergency drugs, and then proceed with the GA. Anything that you want to add on to that?
The only thing I would add for GAs in obstetrics would be anticipating higher risk of difficult airway and higher risk of awareness. We've talked about what we would do if they were coming for a cesarean section with no anaesthetic on board. But obviously, some of them might have had a wonderful epidural put in by yourself. Okay, can I top up this epidural or not? So top tips for this, I think we would say be very careful about which epidurals you top up and which epidurals you say, no, I'm not happy with that. if you've got an epidural that has not worked well during labour, you have a very high chance of it not working well for a cesarean section. So I would have a very low threshold for removing that epidural and just doing a spinal. Being mindful that you have a fully loaded epidural space, so that spinal that you put in will potentially travel up to a higher level than if you put it in somebody who hadn't had an epidural. So just being mindful for a high block and thinking about your volumes is important there. There are lots of different combinations of solutions for topping up epidurals, which we have a drugs episode on. And there are also some brilliant guidelines on how to top up epidurals and whether or not to top them up, which we will link to the bottom of the bio of this episode. Just remember that even if somebody has a really nicely working epidural up to T10 on both sides, that is not an anaesthetic block, that's an analgesic block. So you still need to be giving good volumes of anaesthetic strength, local anaesthetic, to top that epidural up. And when you do this, don't do it in the room, do it in theatre. Make sure you've checked the block prior to giving any more anaesthetic down it. Make sure you've aspirated properly. Be mindful that that tip of the epidural catheter might have moved. It might now be intrathecal. And when you're giving test doses...
Or intravascular.
Or intravascular, yeah, that's true. And when you're giving test doses, give small amounts and reevaluate the block. The guidelines as to what to do with a failed epidural top-up as well will differ depending on where you're working. Your choices are do a spinal full dose, do a spinal reduced dose, do a combined spinal epidural, or do a GA. And whether or not you do one of those things will be dependent on the woman, your skill level, the time of day, what other staff you've got around, and what your departmental guidelines are. But again, we will link the various review articles and guidelines to the bottom of this episode, because it's a grey area where you just want to do what's the safest thing for the woman at that time. Remember that the care of the woman is your first concern. Although there's a baby and that baby might be in distress, your priority is the mother. So be empowered. If you feel like you're being put in a difficult situation, you think they might have a difficult airway, or you're worried about giving someone an anaesthetic, call for help, call a friend, and don't be pressurised into an unsafe situation.
Easier said than done.
Yes, it is.
You mentioned a combined spinal epidural. What is that?
That's a technique that will be on different regions. That's where they will either, using the same kit, they'll insert an epidural needle and then use a spinal needle through the epidural to be able to insert a low dose or high dose mix, because they can be used for epidurals for labour, or it can be used for anaesthesia for cesarean sections as well. So the dose goes in and then the epidural needle then gets threaded after the spinal needle gets taken out into the epidural space, and then that can be used to prolong the regional anaesthesia duration. Or if it's an epidural for labour, it can be used to initiate, I've said 45 minutes earlier, for a working epidural. Well, this epidural can now work in 5.
The theoretical benefit is that the spinal dose that you give can be reduced, but then you've still got the epidural component to add more anaesthetic or analgesia if you want to. So in that scenario, say, for example, I've done a full epidural top-up and it's not worked, you could potentially do a CSE, only put, for example, a mil in the spinal component, and then you've got an epidural catheter there to top up if you need, rather than giving a full spinal dose because you're worried that an underdose might not be enough. But they are a technique that's less familiar, and there is a higher failure rate of one or other component, and you've got an epidural catheter that's untested because it hasn't been used during labour. So there are pros and cons to both techniques, but that's where you might see them used.
Okay, it's for the advanced.
Or the pernickety.
In GA, it's quite important to mention as a decision algorithm. We've already mentioned as difficult airways, increased risk of awareness. I mean, the risk factors for awareness are essentially an obstetric night shift, right? It's a junior anaesthetist with a comorbid patient, with a female, young.
Yeah. RSI.
RSI.
Bleeding.
just be aware of that with the agents you're giving, and be aware of that when you're consenting. There's also a treatment algorithm for what to do if you are unable to intubate in an obstetric patient, and a decision tree that's been released by the Difficult Airway Society on whether or not to proceed, or whether or not to hold off to wait for senior support. So we're going to put that link in bio, and I'd really recommend reading it before you start.
So I guess what would your top tips be for someone working on labour ward as an anaesthetist?
Be clear with your communication. When do you want the oxytocin? If you haven't heard, what are the antibiotics you want? What are the uterotonics? Be confident in your voice and be seen. I think you are a patient advocate when everyone else is thinking about the baby. Very important. You are the advocate for the patient, so be an advocate for the patient. Yeah.
I think I'm almost entirely either doing a procedure, talking to the woman, or giving drugs until the baby is out and I'm happy that the obstetricians are happy with the tone. And then I will say to the woman, I'm just going to write down what's happened so far. I'm just behind you at this anaesthetic machine. If you need anything, just shout. Mm. And then I will do all of my writing down. But the rest of the time, I'm focusing on what stage of the procedure they're at, pre-warning the woman, okay, so you might feel a little bit of pushing now, for example, when they're pressing to get the baby out. And then I'm watching them like a hawk to see what's happening, because a silent obstetrician is sometimes a bit concerning. So be mindful about what is happening and what's going on, and don't worry about the computer writing things down until you're happy that everything is in a stable position.
To wrap up, I think hopefully that gives you a bit more of an insight on what we do on labour wards, and hopefully makes you a bit more excited about being there, because I know people reflect on OB saying, oh, it's a busy time, but you can make such a difference for the patients and the team that you're looking after, and you will be fantastic on it. If you would say that three takeaways that you'll take away from this conversation.
I guess the main thing I've taken away actually is that it's probably the first positive conversation I've had about OBS anaesthetics with other trainees. So it's the main takeaway for me has been that it can be a positive experience, and you can, you know, you will enjoy it.
It will be a positive experience.
The second one being, I guess, the key differences between what procedures you may have done before in a different patient group, what those key differences may be in terms of the maternal physiology and the bits of kit that you use. And I guess another big one is that there's a lot of new procedures that you'll be learning, and it's nice to hear that you don't have to be great at them straight away, and that you will fail and get better. And so when you're on that night shift and you're feeling awful about having to ring a reg because you failed three times an epidural, I'll be like, well, Owen said it's okay.
Yeah, you can, and you can quote me on that, Serena, as well, when they're for some reason grumpy.
OBS can be really humbling.
Yeah.
But I think your takeaways are absolutely bang on. And, you know, you could be the best epiduralist in the world, but you're putting a needle into a relatively blind space, and all you can do is try your best and call for help when you don't get it.
Cool. Well, that's all from me.
And me.
And me.
NovPod out.
Hello and welcome to the outro. I hope you've enjoyed that conversation with Serena, Rosie and I. Links in the bio that we will discuss is the recommendations for checking a spinal, the DAS maternity airway algorithm, e-learning for healthcare modules. Rosie and I managed to persuade Serena to stay for another episode, so she will join us for episode 4, pathophysiology that we encounter on the labour ward. So goodbye for now.